offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, The Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, having the pleasure of joining you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. We are going through the third chapter, and we are pretty much in the end of the third chapter. I think we should complete in a couple of weeks. This is a program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita chapter by chapter, verse by verse, and we just completed last week extensive and a deep discussion on shloka number 35. And shloka number 35 talks about a very important theme in Bhagavad Gita, and that is the topic of swadharma. Excuse me. And I think that's why we took enough time to go through it. We will also see how that is a point where there is the discourse that Krishna is giving takes a break to suggest that that's an important topic that Krishna is talking about. As always, I think we'll start with a short summary of what we covered last time, and that is in essence a brief of chapter shloka number 35 of chapter 3 and the discussion on Swadharma itself. In the shloka, Krishna says that it is better to follow one's swadharma, even if it is done imperfectly, than to follow paradharma, even if it is done perfectly. And then, of course, in the second line, he goes on to say that even if one were to perish in the process of following swadharma, it is better, because following paradharma is dangerous and wrought with ruin. We then saw what Swami's definition of swadharma is. We started off from that point where Swami says swa stands for the self, and so swadharma in reality is atma dharma. So the real self is the atma, so swadharma equals to atma dharma, which means doing every action that one performs with the motive of moving towards the ultimate goal, that is the realization of the atma. And that alone can be qualified as swadharma, is what Swami says. And we quoted Swami's Dharma Vahini for this understanding. Paradharma, of course, Swami goes on to say that just like how swadharma is atma dharma, paradharma is deha dharma. It is often translated as the dharma of another person, but Swami clearly states it is deha dharma, or when actions are performed to attain anything that is related to the body or the worldly plane can be defined as paradharma. Swadharma is usually defined as one's personal dharma, which is a combination of the various dharmas that one is supposed to perform. The dharma that is defined by one's station in life, one's gender, profession, the situation that one is in. But Swami had clearly stated in the quotes that we had gone through that following that which takes one closer to one's goal can alone be defined as swadharma, and everything else is maybe a form of swadharma, as we'll see. So this is the ultimate or the absolute explanation that Swami has given. But in the context of the Gita, as we have seen so far, as we are seeing right now, we can clearly see that Krishna is telling Arjuna not to give up his Kshatriya dharma, and it is in that context he even uses swadharma for the first time in the second chapter, that one must perform the dharma that is based on one's profession and one's birth. So this being the case, how do we reconcile these two definitions that we have? From our discussion that we had seen how what one is supposed to do as dharma towards one's family, or the karma that one is supposed to do professionally or in a given circumstance, can be a form of atma dharma, though it is not atma dharma or swadharma itself. It can be a form or a modification that atma dharma takes at that moment. And the beautiful analogy that Swami gives is that of wood, which can be fashioned as a chair, as a table, but in essence it always remains wood. So when you look beyond the form, what you see is the essential material which it is made of. So how can we say that once in a while the Atma Dharma takes the form of these various dharmas? We had seen three important points, and we had come to that understanding. One is, of course, to perform one's to perform karma yoga, we had come to that understanding where one does not have to change one's profession, one does not have to do any particular form of work. If one is a businessman, he does not have to give up that karma and become a philanthropist or a doctor in that sense, or one does not have to give up being a minister or an engineer and to become a teacher for that matter, or become a Brahmin for that matter. None of these are required for one to perform karma yoga. One can continue to do whatever karma one is performing. So that is one of the points. And the second and the most important point that we had come through is the acknowledgement of God or the divine aspect in life being a very, very critical point for understanding karma yoga. You cannot talk about karma yoga without acknowledging either God as a impersonated being, as you know, you worship God in the form or as somebody who is ruling our own destinies, or you factor in God in the form of the omniscient super intelligence which kind of orchestrates this entire life, right? That's another way of looking at it. But in some way, you will have to factor in the fact that there is a being which has created the system where one does good karma and gets good in return, one does bad karma and gets bad in return, and there is a way by which it can be, this in the cycle of karma and consequences can be broken. There's some intelligence which is guiding this whole thing. And the moment you factor in the presence of God or divinity in life, the fact that each one of us have been precisely placed where we are, be it in the family or in a situation or in the circumstances that we are in or the professions that we are doing, in a very precise manner based on the various calculations of the consequences of our past actions, the give and take that we have with the people that we interact with, all of that has precisely placed us in the situation where we are in. So one point is we don't have to change what we are doing. And the other point is we are placed where we are placed because there are certain give and take that has to be settled. And without settling it, you do not necessarily progress. And even if you avoid doing what you're supposed to do, you will have to come back in some other form, or this same debt has to be settled in some other form. So given these calculations and given these points that I just mentioned, we can say that for a person who is at any point to dispense one's duty with the desire to settle whatever has to be settled and move towards one's goal becomes a clear expression of one's swadharma. And of course, the final point that we made, which I will be coming back to even in today's discussion, is what Swami says about swadharma is nothing but at every situation, at every point in life, following one's conscience. That could be the clearest and the most lucid description or definition of what swadharma is. Otherwise, it's very, very difficult to define swadharma or atmadharma in any other manner. So Swami says, constantly turning to your conscience and following your conscience is the best definition that you can give for swadharma. So that was the discussion that we had last week on that one particular shloka of the third chapter, chapter number 3, shloka 35. We will go forward. As I said, there is a break in the discourse, so to say, because at this point now Arjuna asks a question, and we've seen in the past also whenever Arjuna asks a question, it's clearly a change in the theme, or it is a deeper question which kind of seeks clarification from Krishna to explain further. So we'll listen to shloka number 36. I'll give you the brief meaning and then we will progress as always. We have the shloka rendered in the clear voice of Brother Shyam. We'll listen to it and then we'll take it from there.
अर्जुन उवाच अथ केन प्रयुक्तोयम् पापं चरति पुरुषः अनिच्छन्नपि वार्ष्णेय बलादिव नियोजितः.
Arjuna said, but impelled by what does man commit sin? Though against his own wishes, or Vashneya, constrained as it were by force. So that's the verse number 36. And as I was just saying, Arjuna asks a very, very important question. And more or less, whenever Arjuna asks a question like this, if you see, there is a certain completion of the theme till the previous verse. And it is almost like Krishna has said something very, very important and he has taken a pause, and then Arjuna places his doubt. And that also suggests that whatever Krishna has said so far, ending in chapter in verse number 35, is a very, very important topic, the topic of Swadharma. So going to what Krishna, what Arjuna is asking here, he says, Varshneya, he refers to Krishna as Varshneya. We have come across this appellation once already. This is the name of Krishna which has been mentioned even in the second chapter. It comes from Krishna being the descendant of a leader called Vrishni. He is one of the leaders of the Yadava clan. So Arjuna says, O Varshneya, Atha, now, Kena Prayuktaha, impelled by what? Papam charati purushaha, a man performs sins. Anichchannapi, even though he doesn't want to. Balat iva, as if by force. Niyojitaha, pushed or urged. I think I'd mentioned this particular shloka even very much in the beginning of this entire series, in the curtain raiser episode itself. We were discussing about what made Arjuna a qualified recipient of the Bhagavad Gita. And at that time, I had actually made a mention of this particular verse, where this is a clear contrast of how Arjuna approached life and how Duryodhana had approached the same problem. To quickly repeat what I had mentioned in that episode, when Krishna was trying to advise Duryodhana about dharma, because that question always comes, you know, why does Krishna have to advise Arjuna, who is pretty much seems like a good person? This advice would have been better served to Duryodhana, who is the troublemonger, right? And the story goes that Krishna does try his best to advise and counsel Duryodhana too. But when he tries to do that, Duryodhana responds with one particular verse where he says, Janami dharmam nachame pravrittihi. Janami adharmam nachamena vrittihi, kinapi devena hridisthitena yatha niyuktosmi tatha karomi. He says, I know what is dharma, you don't have to tell me. I know what is dharma, but I don't feel like following it. I know what is adharma too, but I don't feel like refraining from it. Then very beautifully adds in the second line, there seems to be a master seated in my heart. As he dictates, I do. So this was Duryodhana's mention of the same topic, right, what we are talking about. So Duryodhana also was wise enough to recognize that there was something that was pushing him from within. But the difference was he did not want to challenge it. He was expressing it as a matter of fact. He is expressing it to Krishna as something that happens and you have to accept me as I am, almost in that sense. But here Arjuna is posing it as a question. He is asking, what is it? What is that that makes me to act even though I don't want to? And when he asks in this manner, it is with a hidden hope that it can be dealt with and it can be overcome. Right? And that is the essential difference. Duryodhana says, this is how I am and that is why I am following a dharma. But Arjuna is saying that this is how it is, but I want to know what propels this, so that is there a way by which it can be overcome. But as we've already seen, Krishna did answer this to a certain extent in a couple of verses back. He said it is prakriti, right? He says it is that swabhava which is there within that propels man to act, whether it is good or bad, right or wrong. And that prakriti, in fact, expresses in the conscious mind as likes and dislikes, as raga and dvesha. And he also went on to say that one must not be a slave to these two, raga and dvesha. And it is in this context that the topic of Swadharma comes, that he says without being swayed by one's likes and dislikes, one must perform one's Swadharma. So what is the idea of Arjuna asking this question? One thing is, probably Arjuna was not satisfied with that explanation. He wants to go a little more deeper. And even more importantly, why is it that we are able to do this? Why some people are able to do this and some people are not able to do? When we talk about dharmic people, when we talk about people who are following their dharma, and we talk about people like Duryodhana who are not able to follow their dharma, as Krishna had mentioned, there is prakriti which is propelling even a jnani, right? So Arjuna is asking, why is it that there some people are able to do it, some people are not able to do it? And more importantly, why is it that when we look at our own selves, why is it that sometimes we are able to follow dharma, sometimes we are being overpowered, right? So that is a nuanced question that Arjuna is asking. Though Krishna has explained about prakriti and swabhava and everything, Arjuna is saying that why is it that it is not easily, one cannot overcome it, and why is it that sometimes you can overcome it and sometimes you cannot overcome it, right? And I think what weakens my resolve to follow my dharma is probably the bottom line of what Arjuna is asking Krishna. So Krishna explains this in the next shloka, in the next following shloka. So we'll listen to shloka number 37 and then we'll discuss about what Krishna is telling, a very, very important point that Krishna is making in the next shloka.
Shri Bhagavanuvacha Kama Esha Krodha Esha Rajoguna Samudbhavaha Mahashano Mahapapma Vidhyena Miha Vairinam.
The Blessed Lord said, this desire, this anger, born of the quality of Rajas, is a great devourer, a great sinner. Know this to be the enemy here. Krishna has actually given a reply which is quite subtle and it needs a little bit of rumination and explanation. The explanation that I'm going to give is something that helped me understand this better, and it is a personal interpretation, so I would invite all of you to take it with a little bit of your own self-reflection. So what is Arjuna's question here? He says, Papam charati purushah anichchannapi. He says, man does sin even when he doesn't wish to. If I were to rephrase that particular thing, what Arjuna is saying, he's saying man does sin even when he doesn't wish to. When you say he doesn't wish to, which means he wishes not to, right? If I could put it that way. So instead of saying man does sin even when he doesn't wish to, I can say man is not able to refrain from sin even when he wishes to. So which means that Arjuna is talking about two desires here, or Arjuna is talking about a desire to refrain from sin. He's saying that I have the desire to refrain from sin or refrain from adharma, but this desire seems to be overruled by something. And Arjuna is asking, what overrules this desire? I hope you're following what I'm saying. Arjuna is asking, I don't want to do sin, but I still do. Which means I have this desire to refrain from sin. There is a desire in me. There is this pious desire that I should do the right and not do what is wrong. But this desire is being overruled by something. And what is it? Right? That's what Arjuna asks. And what is Krishna's answer to that? He says, desire overrules it. Right? That's what he says. But this desire that Krishna is talking about, this desire that Arjuna is talking about is the desire to follow one's swadharma, to be moral, to refrain from sinful acts. This desire is overruled by the desire that Krishna is talking about, a certain type of desire. So what is that? Krishna says, Kama Esha, this desire, Krodha Esha, this anger. Krishna is referring to desire and anger as the answer, right? He's saying that anger and desire is overruling it. And as I just said, not wanting to sin is also a desire or a kama. Then how is this kama that Krishna is talking about different? One hint is he is equating it to krodha or anger. There's one form of desire that is closely connected with anger. In the second chapter that we had gone through, Krishna had said, Sangat sanjayate kamaha kamat krodho abhijayate. from attachment comes karma, and from that karma comes krodha or anger. And we had discussed how when the desire that grows out of attachment or sangha is denied or delayed, anger is born. So Krishna clarifies further in this particular shloka that we are going through, kama esha krodha esha rajoguna samudbhavaha. So he says, kama esha krodha esha rajoguna samudbhavaha. This desire, this anger that is born out of rajoguna, mahashano, it is a devourer, it consumes everything. And here in this context, it is described as that which devours reason and good sense. Mahapapma, it is sinful by nature. Vidhiyenam, know this to be iha vairinam, as the enemy here. So this is my understanding that I was talking about. There are two kinds of desires. Desires that are born out of good impulses. What Arjuna is talking about. He's saying, I have the desire to refrain from the wrong. I have the desire to perform the good actions. Or the quality that is, or the desires that are born out of the quality of sattva. And the other desire that Krishna is talking about is the desire that is born out of rajas. The desire that is born out of rajas or passion is a spin-off from attachment. And that craving, the craving that is born out of attachment is the desire which Krishna is talking about, right? And as Krishna had explained in the second chapter, that that particular desire which comes from attachment and craving very, very quickly transforms into anger and delusion and loss of memory and leads one to ruin very, very swiftly. And the source of this anger is sangha or attachment. And that attachment comes from contemplating on objects of desires, right? Dhyayate vishayan pumshaha, Krishna says in that particular verse that we quoted. And that starts with the sense organs being drawn towards them. And I think a few verses from now, towards the end of the chapter, Krishna is going to talk about this in detail, about how you can overcome this, right? Because that's the inner motive of what Arjuna is asking. He's asking this question not to be informed, but he wants to understand what is blocking and how it can be overcome. So that Krishna is going to come to in a short while. But this is the basic explanation that Krishna gives him. There are two kinds of desires in us. There is a desire to be good, right? That desire is there in each one of us. The desire to be a good person, the desire to follow dharma. And the problem is, it is being, when it finds itself in conflict with the desire which is born out of attachment, the desire which is born out of the rajoguna. And that overpowers this, is what Krishna says. So how do you control that? Is, as I said, the theme of what comes towards the end of the chapter. But this is the explanation that Krishna gives in this particular verse, that the desire that is born out of rajoguna overpowers the desire that is born out of sattva or the basic instinct, right? Because towards the end we will see how this desire which is born out of sattva is more native to us than that desire which is born out of rajoguna, because it is coming from outside, whereas this is coming as an internal impulse. We'll go to the next verse. In the next couple of verses, Krishna actually is going to explain this nature of this anger a little more in detail, and more importantly, the quality of desire more than quality of anger, because anger is something which comes later. So he's going to talk about this quality of desire, how it overpowers reason or how it overpowers the desire to do the right thing, with a few very, very graphic analogies, and then he's going to explain this. So we'll listen to shloka number 38 and then we'll discuss about it.
Dhumena vriyate vannihi yatha darsho malena cha yatol bena vruto garbhaha tatha tene damavritam.
As fire is enveloped by smoke, as a mirror by dust, and as an embryo by the amnion, so is this enveloped by that. Krishna says that this desire and anger that comes from Rajoguna envelops this sattvic desire to do the right actions. And how does it do it? He gives a few very, very beautiful and graphic analogies. As I said, there are three analogies that Krishna gives in this verse number 38. He says, Dhumena avriyate vahnihi yatha. Dhuma means smoke. Avriyate means to cover. Vahni is fire. So, Dhumena avriyate vahnihi yatha. Just as smoke covers the fire, Adarsho malena cha. Adarsha means a mirror, and malena, mala means dust or dirt. So adarsho malena cha means just as dust covers a mirror, yata ulbena avrito garbha. Garbha is the fetus, and ulbena is the the membrane which covers that fetus in the womb, or it could well be referred to as the fetus which is covered in the womb. He says, yata ulbena avrito garbha. Just that the fetus is covered by the amnion in the womb, tatha, in the same manner, tena, that idam avritam covers here. He says, tena idam avritam, that covers here. So, Krishna, this, as you can see, this is not a shloka which is complete in itself, because he's saying that covers this. Of course, though it is understandable from the point of view of whatever we have discussed so far, this is going to be made more clear in the next verse, what covers what. So maybe before we start discussing about the similes that Krishna gives and the importance and the significance of all of this, we'll probably go to the next shloka also. We'll listen to that, and then I'll give you a brief meaning of that, and then we'll discuss both of these shlokas together, because both of these are very, very important. They give us a hint of how it has to be dealt with, though Krishna does not talk about it till the next verse, next couple of verses. There's a hint of how this desire has to be dealt with from the analogies that Krishna is giving, and of course what he's going to talk about in the next verse also. So we'll listen to verse number 39 also, and then we'll discuss about it.
Avritam jnanametena jnanino nitya vairina kamarupena kaunteya dushpurena nalena cha.
O Arjuna, wisdom is enveloped by this constant enemy of the wise in the form of desire, which is unappeasable as fire. In the previous verse, Krishna gave us three analogies, right? He said, like the smoke covers the fire, the dust covers the mirror, and the fetus is covered in the womb. Here Krishna says, what covers what, if it has not been made clear already. He says, Kaunteya, O Arjuna, son of Kunti, avritam jnana metena. Jnana is covered by this. He says, jnana is covered by this, by what? Jnanino nitya vairina, the eternal enemy of a jnani. Kama rupena, it is in the form of kama or desire. Dushpurena analena cha. Dushpurena means insatiable, and anala means fire. So kama rupena dushpurena analena cha means it is in the form of desire and insatiable like fire. This is a very, very beautiful explanation that Shankara gives in his commentary for this particular verse. Why Krishna is saying jnanino nitya vairina, it is a constant enemy of the wise. Why is it a constant enemy of the jnani and not a constant enemy of probably the opposite of a jnani, a murkha, right, or the unwise? Why is it not a constant enemy of the unwise, whereas it is a constant enemy of the wise? He says that those who lack discrimination, what we could refer to as an aviveki, one who does not have the discrimination. Viveki is one who has discrimination. Aviveki is one who does not have discrimination, or a murkha, or a fool. These people blindly follow desires when they occur in the mind. As we said, there is the prakriti or the gunas in the mind form the swabhava or the prakriti of a person, the nature of the person. That nature of the person expresses itself as desires in the mind. And once the desires occur in the mind, a wise person is supposed to put it through the filter of discrimination or buddhi. But a person who is unwise tries to pursue every desire that comes in the mind, whether his dharma permits it or not. Right? That's the definition of a agnani, or a person who does not follow his dharma. It's pretty much like what Duryodhana is doing. He's got this desire for being a ruler, being a king. Even though his dharma does not permit it, he is trying to push his way and get it, right? That's the whole problem. But whereas a jnani, or a person who has enough sense, will say that, okay, this desire has come, but this is not to be followed because this does not fit into my framework of dharma. So when you talk about an aviveki who does not have the discrimination, the moment a desire occurs in the mind, he follows it and pursues it as if it is a friend which is guiding him, right? So a person who is an aviveki considers desires as a friend at the time of it occurring in the mind and when he is pursuing it. But much later, when something goes wrong pursuing that particular desire, right, as probably is going to happen to Duryodhana, when he's going to lose everything, he's going to lose his kingdom. It happens to in the case of Ravana, when Ravana is drawn and driven by his karma or his lust. Towards the end, he, just before the final battle, he realizes what a mistake he has done. He has ruined his whole clan. He has ruined his whole kingdom. He has lost all his sons. But it did not occur to him what he was doing was wrong when he was pursuing his desires. So at that time, it appeared like this was the right thing to do, and it was being the right counsel that his mind was giving. So an aviveki, or one who does not have discrimination, at the time of pursuing the desire, thinks it is a friend. But when the desire leads one to ruin, as we saw, that is how the sequence happens. Karma leads to krodha, krodha leads to delusion, and so on and so forth. And eventually it leads to finally ruin. When the stage of final ruin comes, at that time the person looks back and says, oh my God, the desires ruined me. Or to see the desire and say that these are my enemies, they have brought me to this current state, right? So an aviveki considers the desires as an enemy much later, but when it comes to the question of a viveki, or a person who is wise, a jnani, as it is said here, jnani no nitya vairina. For a jnani, for the wise one, these are eternal enemies, because the moment it arises in the mind, he becomes cautious, or she becomes cautious. He says, here comes a desire, I need to be on guard. So for a person who has discrimination, a desire is an enemy from the beginning to the end. Whereas for a person who lacks that discrimination, the desire appears to be a friend initially, but when it eventually leads to ruin, he or she looks at it and says, oh, this desire was never my friend, right? And this is the very, very beautiful explanation that Shankara gives for this particular statement, jnani no nitya vairina. For a jnani, or for a wise one, the desires are a constant enemy, not an enemy at a later stage. And the other reason why the desires are spoken of as a constant threat is they can never be satiated. Krishna uses the phrase dushpurena analena cha. He says dushpurena analena cha. Pura means to fill. The word purna comes from this particular root, right? Pura, to fill. Dushpura means it can never be filled, or it can never be satisfied, insatiable. Dushpurena analena. It is insatiable like fire. If you consider the nature of fire, the fire consumes any combustible object that you throw at it. Now, if there is a fire in front of me, and if I start pulling out all the combustible objects in this room and I start throwing at it, there is no point in time when the fire will say, I've had enough, right? There'll be no point in time when the fire would say that, okay, I've had enough for my day, let me stop. If I were to put all the combustible things in the entire world, still the fire will still keep consuming and keep eating that up, right? That's why fire is referred to as being insatiable. Never will the fire say, okay, I think I've burnt enough for today, and display vairagya or renunciation spontaneously, isn't it? To put off the fire, you have to put off the fire, right? You cannot put off the fire by feeding it. In the same way, desire cannot be sublimated by constantly satisfying it, because desire is dushpurena analena. It is like fire which is insatiable. The more you give it, it'll keep consuming, 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 and keep asking for more. So by feeding it, it never goes away. So Krishna says, such desire, which is born out of rajas, covers one's discrimination, and that is why we are not able to follow the path of dharma from time to time, even though we wish to. Now the reason that Arjuna asked the question, what causes this delusion, is not purely to have that data with him or information with him. He wanted to know how to deal with it, right? How to overcome it. Krishna, as I said, is going to be explaining that in a little more detail in the chapter end, which will be the verses I think we'll be taking up next week. But let us go back to the previous verse for a bit, and the verse number 38, where Krishna gives these three very, very graphic and beautiful analogies. The three analogies that he gives, if I could go back to that, he says, Dhumena avriyate vahni. Dhuma means smoke, vahni means fire. Dhumena avriyate vahni, like how smoke covers fire. Yata ulbena avrito garba. That's the third one. Before that he says, adarsho malena cha, like a mirror is covered by dust. And yata ulbena avrito garba, like how the fetus is covered by the womb. What is the relevance or the importance of these particular three analogies that Krishna is giving here? One common point in all of this is the negative, or that which covers or that which overpowers, is not native to us, right? The good impulse that we're talking about is native. And that's why in all of these analogies, you talk about fire. Fire is being covered, which means even when it is being covered, the fire is there. When you talk about the mirror's reflective power being covered by dust, even though the dust is there, the mirror's ability to reflect does not go away. Even though the child is in the womb and cannot be seen, nobody can deny the presence of the child in the womb. There are other ways by which its presence can be felt, right? So in all these three examples, the common thing is that the impulse is native, and that which obstructs that impulse, that good impulse, that dharmic impulse, is something which is temporary and which covers from the exterior, right? So the impulse to follow the right, the impulse to follow dharma, is there in each one of us without exception. Even the worst of criminals have it in them, and it is the true state or the true nature of each one of us, right? In fact, that is what is referred to as the conscience. That's why I was telling you in the beginning, when we talk about Swadharma, Swami says eventually the best definition that you can give for Swadharma, which each one of us can relate to, we could be a very noble person, we could be a person of very cruel nature, whoever we are, we all have this tryst with our conscience. We all know that there is something within which kind of nags us when we do something wrong, or which kind of propels us to do something which is right. That's an experience which is universal. We may or may not give it enough time to understand that there is something which is propelling us from within, but Swami says it's a universal experience everybody goes through, that there is this conscience which reacts. But this conscience, if you look at it, I think in one of the answers that I'd given as part of the answering booth, we had discussed in detail about the nature of this conscience, what we refer to as conscience. And why is it that even though there is a conscience, sometimes we would find children behaving in a manner which is immoral? If you talk about conscience being everywhere, and if you talk about purity leading to a state where the conscience is being more pronounced, we should be able to see you know, children exhibiting that more clearly. But we sometimes see children being violent, children being very irrational. Because what we talk of the conscience, or what we talk about we listening to the voice within, is nothing but the effulgence of the Atma being reflected upon the Buddhi or the reasoning mind. So to a certain extent, the maturity of the mind also factors in, right? What we talk about as our worldly understanding of right and wrong and how one thing has to be done is there. It gets illumined, or it gets its clarity from the conscience being reflected upon it, right? So that is what we refer to as conscience. It is almost like a mirror on which a light is being reflected upon. And the more there is dust on this mirror, more dull will be the light which is being reflected. So when we talk about dust or dirt on the surface of the mirror, this is again an analogy which Krishna is giving. So there are three analogies that he is giving. One is smoke covers fire. The other is the dust or dirt which covers a mirror, and then the womb which covers the fetus. When we are talking about smoke covering the fire, or let's say even the idea of ashes over embers, it doesn't require much effort to blow out the fire, to blow out the smoke, or to blow out the ashes and to be able to see the fire. But when you talk about dust or dirt on the surface of a mirror, just blowing or dusting it may not be sufficient, isn't it? You may have to wipe it with a wet cloth, or you might have some other means of cleaning it so that it starts to see. But when you're talking about embers covered with ash, just by blowing it, or just by, you know, fanning it, you'll be able to see the fire. But when it comes to a mirror, there's a little more effort that is required. But when it comes to a child in the womb, there is nothing that can be really done. It remains in that state for a certain period of time, and at a certain point, it reveals itself, right? There's nothing for me to do for it to reveal itself. So the desires that cloud our discrimination is also of these three types. One is easy to push away. The other needs a little bit of effort. And the third thing is, there is no effort which directly makes it go away. We are walking down the road, and let's say we walk past a mall, we walk past a shop with a window filled with all kinds of articles, or we are crossing the road and we see this very, very expensive car. When we look at these objects, we certainly have for a moment that desire of how nice that object is, or, you know, you place yourself behind the wheels of such a car, or you imagine yourself wearing that particular dress. I think all of us have multiple desires like this which occur to us in our everyday life. When you're driving to work, when you're out in a vacation, there are a lot of such desires which occur to us when we interact with the world outside. But it is very, very easy to put away these desires. A little bit of discrimination is all that it takes. Or as they say, it just takes for one peep into your purse or into your wallet to say that, no, I can't afford this, and I just let it pass. Many, many desires in our life come to us like this and go away without any trace. And we get done with it without much effort, right? So that is the first form of desires that we have. We look at it, we get perturbed for a minute, sometimes not even perturbed. We just say, wow, that's a nice thing. And then we turn and carry on with our life. So these desires are fleeting by nature, and it does not take anything more than just a moment of reflection or a moment of, you know, grounding yourself to your reality and saying that, no, this is not worth going. You see a very expensive car and you kind of see, this is where my salary slip is, and definitely I'm not going to be able to afford that. So you look away, you don't spend the time of thinking about it at all, because you have enough discrimination to discard it then and there. There could be any number of reasons for that. Maybe because it's much beyond me at this particular point in time, or, you know, it's just an object that I'm not really keen on pursuing at this point in time. Whatever be the case, it does not cloud my dharma. It is not so persistent or strong enough to to cloud my dharma, and it does not require me too much effort to do away with it, right? So that is the first category of desires that Krishna is talking about here when he says there are some desires which are like the smoke that covers the fire. All that it requires is just say woof and it just goes away, right? Then comes the second type of desire, which do not go away all that easily. These desires tend to remain in our mind and in a way make us lose our peace and our stability. What Krishna referred to as those that we go on contemplating on and get attached to, right? Dhyayate vishayan pumshah. You look at an object, you constantly contemplate about it, and every time you have an opportunity, you think about it. And every now and then you see whether you're able to afford that thing or what you have to do to get it. Those kind of objects are the second category that Krishna is talking about here. Those that do not go away all that easily, and a little more willpower is required to overcome them. You don't need as much willpower for dealing with the first category of desires, but for this particular category, you need a very firm will to do it. One must firmly dismiss these desires. And much of the desires which cause problem to us fall in this category, right? This is probably the largest category of desires that we are going to be dealing with, where with it can be dismissed with a little bit of effort, but that little bit of effort and little bit of willpower is required. And most of us falter in this category, where if we just take a little bit more time to reflect on, is this necessary for me? And not only is it about just a reflection, just like how the example that we spoke about of dust or dirt which settles on the surface of a mirror, merely blowing it does not help. You need to do an act which kind of counters the dirt on the mirror. You probably have to get a wet cloth and wipe. This is similar to how you have to deal with these desires. Sometimes you have to counter them with a very firm no to yourself, probably through an action, right? There are some ways by which, I don't have any major examples to give, but there are some ways by which you kind of say that this is not right for me or this is not something I want. There's this, those of you followers on Instagram would have seen, we recently posted a beautiful picture, a beautiful video which was sent to us by one of our listeners and one of our avid readers from Australia, where they were talking about they've trained their dog at home to eat its food only after one of them chant the Brahmarpanam prayer. And it's so very beautiful to see the discipline of that little dog, where it is sitting before its food. The food is right in front of it. It's dinner time or lunch time or whatever it is. And it is patiently waiting for them to complete the chanting of Brahmarpanam. And you will see that at one point the dog is probably getting restless and the dog actually turns away from the food. It doesn't look at the food and it waits for them to finish and then it looks at the food. This is often spoken of as one of the mechanisms which we use to deal with these desires, where we do something which counters the way we kind of try to remove it from our life in a manner that it doesn't disturb us. Many of them will do that. You know, when you walk past a particular mall every day and you look at a particular object and it keeps nagging at you and, that desire becomes strong. There are some people who might choose to take a different route. He says, the more I keep seeing it, the more it's going to trouble me, and so let me not see it, because I've decided that this is not the time for me to acquire it. So you come up with some way of countering that particular desire in a strong manner. So these are desires which pure reflection will not help. You need to take some assertive action to ensure that this does not trouble us anymore, right? So this category of desire falls under what Krishna says is like a dust which covers the mirror. The final example is that of a child in the womb. There is no action that you can do to uncover this child from the womb. Of course, don't take the example literally and don't tell me that yes, you can perform a cesarean. No, I'm not talking about that. Even to perform a cesarean, you need to let a certain amount of time pass, right? So there are some desires which nothing that you do directly affect them or directly make them go away. Nothing that you can do can uncover the fetus in the womb. you have to give it its time and eventually it will go. Which means the self-reflection has to go on. The actions that assert what you want and what you don't want, what we spoke about, that also has to go on. You never give up that. You constantly keep at that. That also has to go on. But at the same time, if the results of that is not seen, if the delusion does not go away, if the desire does not go away, you do not lose heart, because that is the nature of those desires. They will go away with time. And one of the most classic example of such desires which we can talk about is the desires which come with age, right? At a certain point, there are some desires which come, the hormonal changes in the body. There are some desires which are related to the body at that particular time. When you're young, when you're in your, in the grihastha phase of your life. So these are desires which cannot necessarily be done away with by reflecting or by doing something. So it will go away with time by itself. But what you have to do is to ensure that you do not do anything wrong when under the influence of these desires. The only thing that you can do is that you just try to protect yourself and you kind of refrain from action, or as Swami would say, when propelled by such karma and you have to act, you just ensure that that karma expresses itself in a dharmic manner. You find a righteous or a dharmic expression for that karma which cannot be done away with through vichara or internal reflection, right? And there are many ways of doing that, and that's why Swami would say, you know, when you talk about the four purusharthas, Swami would say dharma, artha, karma and moksha. There are some desires which cannot be completely overcome, artha and karma. The desire, lust, when you talk about karma in that context, can be referred to as lust. And artha is when you go after money, when you go after security, when you go after achievement. At that age, you know, even our life in that sense can be broken up into different phases where the aspect of rajas is very, very high. So at that time, you probably cannot do away with this just by wishing it. So the best option is try to avoid to act under the influence, and when you're propelled to act, ensure that your actions are done through the lane of dharma, if I could put it that way. You pursue artha and karma, but you ensure that it is always going through the process of dharma. Or as Swami would say, dharma, artha, karma and moksha. Ensure that the desire is always turned towards moksha. The desire is always turned towards the final destination. And whatever artha is there, which has to be gone through in this life, you ensure that it is passing through this filter of dharma. So the third kind of desire which Krishna speaks about is that which nothing can be done about it. It is there, it is here to stay, and with the time it will go away. But you should be careful not to do mistakes when under the influence of such desire. And I think this is a very, very beautiful explanation that Krishna is giving. Though, as I said, the real explanation of how to deal with it is going to come later. But this categorization, I found it very, very helpful, because we are all going through these kind of desires in our life. The very fact that we mix up these things, for some of us, you know, there are some desires for me which might fall in first category, for you it might fall in the second category, right? If you're talking about the desires which are related to age, for a person who is between, you know, lustful desires, if you're talking about, for a person who is in his the age group of between 20 to 30 in the grihastha phase, for him or her to have it, probably it is natural. But if you're at the age of 50 and 60, you're still having it, for you it becomes unnatural, right? So there are a plethora of desires we go through in life. I think it would be very, very useful for us if we are able to distinguish in which category it falls and what kind of action these desires require. And the more and more, I think, as we become mature, a lot of these desires will start populating the first category of, you know, desires, which can be, we very easily get over them by a few moments of discrimination. There's a desire which arises, we look at it and say that, no, I don't want this right now, I'm not pursuing this, I have better things in life to do, or I have higher goals to achieve. It's very easy for you to get over. So I think a sign of maturity probably is, as we go through life, a lot of our desires will start falling into this first category, but there is no hurry for that. All of us will have desires in all these three categories. Krishna gives a very beautiful, a subtle, unspoken tip as to how each one of these has to be dealt with. And when we talk about desires which are driven by, addiction or some form of habit, right? Addiction is probably the extreme of habit, but even by the force of habit, there are some desires that we are not able to give up. So these actually come under desires which are purely propelled by rajas, and these have to be countered. As Swami gave a very, very beautiful example to one of the teachers in the interview room, and he said that, Swami, how do we deal with habits? How do we deal with these cravings which come from habit and addiction? And Swami said, you have a rolled paper. In fact, Swami did demonstrate that. And Swami took a piece of paper and he rolled it and he gave it to this devotee, and this teacher was sitting in front of him and said, now straighten this paper. So as we always do, he took the paper and he rolled it in the reverse direction, and he said, Swami, the paper is straightened. So Swami said, what did you do now? See, there is a, to counter the rolled nature of the paper, you counter it in the other, you roll it in the other way, right? So Swami said, you have desires which pull you in a certain way. It is not enough if you simply try to keep away from them. You have to counter them. You have to counter them with good habits. You have to counter them with good thoughts. So when you have desires which fall into that second category, which need an assertive action from our side, Swami would say, fill your time and fill your mind space with activity which is more noble, which is more productive. So that is one of the ways by which you are, through your action, asserting that this is the desire I don't want to give mind space to, right? So it's a very, very beautiful explanation that Krishna is giving. It is in line with what Krishna said in the second chapter. And going back to that same thing which I've told so many times, second chapter is like the condensed version of the entire Bhagavad Gita. So what Krishna said in the second chapter, he says, you first start contemplating and then it becomes an attachment and then it becomes a very strong craving. And when the craving is denied, it becomes anger. And there's anger, you lose your discrimination. All of that which Krishna said, he is now explaining it further by saying where that desire comes from. That desire is born of rajas. What does that mean when you say that there are desires which are born out of rajas, which Krishna will explain in the next few verses? So we'll come to all of that probably in the next week. I think we should complete the third chapter in the next week, or if not next, the week after that. But for that, you'll have to wait for 1 week. Dear listeners, do join me again next week for the continuation of the Triune Pilgrimage. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I thank you all for joining me week after week. I thank Swami for this opportunity to, along with all of you, dwell into the Bhagavad Gita, and we conclude this program with the prayer that whatever we have discussed, whatever we have read, whatever we have heard, does not remain in the realm of just hearing, reading and listening, but enters the realm of practice. So with that prayer, I most humbly offer this program at Swami's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all again next week, 7:30 p.m. for the resumption of the Triune Pilgrimage of the Gita series.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai.